and cover-ups, etc., and fraud, etc., and the other one who's just quite elderly. And in Mexico, you have two women. And so what they're talking about on the in the political debate in Mexico is really, frankly, light years away from the political debate that we're having in this country. Mexico, strangely Mexico, Amy, becomes like a North Star. When would I have said that? I could have never imagined. And having said that, I'm
and
not...
And you were born in Mexico
And I was born in Mexico, and I've watched the entire political process. I'm not Pollyanna. Impunity and violence against women, corruption, the assassination of multiple candidates, it's a real problem. But Mexico has a different political debate happening now.
And Maria, I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about the major differences between the two candidates policy-wise. Clearly, Claudia Sheinbaum is being supported by the current president, AMLO, and she appears to have a very big lead in the polls. But your sense of their differences?
So they will both say that they are from the left. Xochitl will say that she's center-left. Claudia Sheinbaum will say that she's obviously more to the left. The policy differences have to do kind of with the historical differences between their two parties, as it were. The Morena Party, which was a street activist movement that now has ended up in the presidential palace, versus you have the PRI and the PAN, these are the two oldest parties in Mexico. It would be like the Republicans and the Democrats getting together to support a candidate. It is a very strange coalition. And so what they represent is actually these two very different parts of American history. Having said that, there's a big critique that Claudia Sheinbaum will continue the policies of AMLO. She responds in a retort that's saying, that's a misogynistic question. You're saying that because I'm a woman, I'm only going to follow what a man has done before me. Xochitl Galvez says that she's going to change things, that she will root out corruption, that she has a vision. But interestingly, Juan, when I was with her and spent an hour with her, and 2 days later, I was trying to process, like, what really happened in that hour-long interview? What were we able to get at? Who does she really, what does she really represent? And I came to a strange conclusion. It is strange, but I feel like her entire candidacy is strange because of these parties supporting her. And I said, it's like she's the Sarah Palin of Mexico, the center-left Sarah Palin of Mexico, in the sense that she's kind of like, hi, I'm here, and I just kind of ended up as the main candidate here, and I'm bright, and I'm smart, and I'm a survivor, and everything is going to be fine. And it's like, Mexico is much more complex than that. You know that. Why do you continue to kind of do this performative political stunts? Even here in New York, she ended up riding her bike to the New York Times for a series of interviews there. One, she wasn't wearing a helmet. Who rides a bike in New York without a helmet? And also, why do you want to ride a bike in Times Square? So she does that, and people kind of pick up on these performative acts that she does.
And also, I wanted to ask you about the importance of the Mexican diaspora in the United States. For several years now, Mexicans abroad who are Mexican citizens have been able to vote in the election. Can you talk about the kind of interest there appears to be in the U.S. in Mexican communities?
You know what, Juan? I have been trying to get my Mexican citizenship back because when I became an American citizen in 1989, I had to give up my Mexican citizenship. It got messed up because of the pandemic, but I'm just one of probably millions of Mexicans who would like to be able to have a vote and a participation in the Mexican political process. When you look at how close recent Mexican elections for president have been, you can understand why Mexican parties, presidential campaigns are coming to ask for Mexicans in the United States to vote. It's small now, maybe 200,000 or so. But if you continue to push to get after these votes of Mexicans living in the United States, it could actually be quite influential. And I think for the politics of Mexicans living in the United States, it's a welcome idea that we don't have to decide, am I from here, am I from there? We actually can vote in both places.
I wanted to go to some of the clips, the interviews you've done. This is Xochitl Galvez speaking to you, Maria, about her experience with gender violence.
How do you define feminism?
O sea, yo creo en la igualdad sustantiva en todos los temas, en nuestra vida personal.
She said that she believes in equality for all women in terms of political, economic, and reproductive rights. And to emphasize why this matters to her, she told us she suffered violence as a child.
Porque tuve un papá alcohólico y era brutalmente violento.
This story has become a part of Xochitl Galvez's stump speech. Her father, she says, was a violent man who terrorized her as a child. One time, she tells us in the interview, he pointed a shotgun at her mother and threatened her. She says that they escaped, but that this experience marked her. And then I asked her what she thinks the solution might be for this kind of gender-based violence in Mexico.
Entonces creo que las mujeres deben de tener la certeza.
What Xochitl said to us was that women in Mexico need a support system in cases of violence, and that men need to know that if they commit violence against women, they will be prosecuted.
This is another clip of Latina USA's interview with Claudia Sheinbaum. Futura Media executive producer Penny Leigh Ramirez asks her about her presidency, what it would mean for Mexico. She spoke to her at a campaign rally in Mexico City.
What's going to be unique about your government?
Well, you know, I'm a scientist, so I'm going to put a lot of effort in science and development. We're going to go for women's rights, and we're going to continue bringing education, a good health system for the people, housing. And what I call the rights for the Mexican people.
So that's Claudia Sheinbaum, well, she is the front runner for sure. They both call themselves feminists. Women got the right to vote in Mexico when? In 1953. And what about abortion?
So abortion right now actually is more progressive in Mexico than in the United States. This is actually not like a primary issue in the presidential campaign right now, unlike here in the United States, because what's happening in Mexico is trending towards legalization across the entire country. There are parts of country in Mexican states where it is legal, but it's not kind of the kind of abortion politics that we're having here, where you would expect, Amy, a Catholic country to be making the decisions on abortion like the ones that are being made in the United States that says it has no relationship with the church in its politics. So right now, again, for women on the issue of reproductive rights, more progressive, but on the issue of violence, on the issue of impunity, the number of female candidates running at different parties in different states, lower, much lower down the ballot, being assassinated. It's really a huge issue, and this is the primary contradiction for Mexico. You're going to elect a woman, but you still haven't resolved the fact that women are being murdered at the rate of about 10 to 11 every single day, and the impunity that comes with it.
And Maria, in terms of this issue of Mexico electing a woman president, several Latin American countries have already done so. Chile, Honduras, Argentina, Brazil, and now Mexico. And yet here in the United States, the potential for electing a woman president will have to be postponed for another 4 or 8 years. I'm wondering your sense of the difference, especially with the United States supposedly claiming to represent a much more forward-looking view on equality between the genders.
Well, Juan, you won't be surprised when I say that the North needs to learn from the South. There's always this perspective that the North, the United States, is leading the way, is the way to go. And in fact, what the United States and the feminist movement in the United States needs to do is to look at what happened in Mexico and the rest of Latin America. The number of countries that have elected a woman president in Latin America is stunning, considering the fact that the United States is still at about a third of women in Congress. You have countries like Rwanda that have legalized parity in political representation, and our country is lagging behind. It is huge, Juan. On the issue of immigration and whether or not Claudia or Xochitl, more likely it will be Claudia who ends up as president, will do something profoundly different, fresh, stand up to the United States, say no more remain in Mexico, begin to do kind of political battle on the issue of immigration. As you know, this is one of my key issues as an immigrant journalist in the United States. To be seen. The thought, though, of a Claudia Sheinbaum, who frankly, you know, Stanford educated, speaks perfect English, sitting down in any kind of meeting with a potential Donald Trump is it messes with the brain. Although I don't think she will take things sitting down.
And it's very interesting. There were just major protests in Mexico City outside the Israeli embassy around Gaza. And AMLO, the president, and the Morena Party supporting Mexico joining South Africa in its genocide case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And Claudia Sheinbaum, the front runner following AMLO, ish woman.
Correct. This is extraordinary because the fact that that she is a Jewish woman, but she doesn't really, she's a scientist, so she's not very religious, but she is a Jewish woman, and then her name is Sheinbaum. It's not a big issue, which is fascinating in and of itself. In some ways, my colleagues, Mexican journalists, in many ways are leading this conversation of how you cover politics and you don't play into authoritarian and propaganda games. For example, there might have been journalists who wanted to kind of fuel the fire of saying, but she's Jewish, she's Jewish. It hasn't really been an issue. And if what's more interesting is that Claudia Sheinbaum and Xochitl Galvez, both of them wearing huipiles, which is the traditional indigenous Mexican, you know it because of the embroidery. This is the fact that both of them are like, we love indigenous women, we love our indigenous roots. Again, fascinating for Mexican politics, which again, to me, that would be the word that I use in terms of Mexican politics right now. Fascinating. That is not the term that I would use when discussing U.S. politics at all.
And Maria, finally, in terms of the legacy of Andrés Manuel López Obrador, obviously he came into office with a lot of hopes of progressives around the hemisphere. He remains very popular, but of course he's under a lot of criticism for his handling or his mishandling of the femicides, of the killing of journalists, of his dealings with the United States in terms of immigration. Your sense of how he will be remembered and what were his accomplishments?
Well, it is a very divisive time in Mexican politics as well, so we can't walk away from that. I mean, my own family is deeply divided. This feels very much like U.S. politics. Families divided. We won't talk about politics over dinner or no political conversations because of how divisive it is. Look, AMLO, again, came from a street movement to end up in the presidential palace. You're right, all of the critiques that surround him, but there is a lot of support for the policies that he's done, specifically in terms of progressive policies regarding, let's say, protection for workers, protection for domestic workers, raising the minimum wage. These kinds of issues, which are getting to the class divisions in Mexico, if you're progressive, you're supporting these policies. If you are, let's say, more on the conservative side, you see AMLO and his policies as a threat. You see his populism as a threat. By the way, understand how threatening a populist movement can be. We're seeing it here in the United States. But there is going to be a legacy that he, in fact, wants to make history and be remembered as the president that changed the trajectory of a modern Mexico. For those who support him, they will say he did that. For those who are critiques, will say he began taking Mexico down the tubes. And they are unforgiving. They do not like AMLO and they do not like Claudia. But more than likely, that will not change in the polls in terms of Claudia walking away with the presidency.
Maria Hinojosa, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, Futuro Media founder, host of Latino USA. Congratulations. It's turning 30 years old. And we will link to your just released episode, A Presidenta Will Lead Femicide Plagued Mexico, ahead of Mexico's elections this Sunday. Next up, America's Monster. How the U.S.-backed kidnapping, torture, and murder in Afghanistan. We'll speak with New York Times journalist Matthew Akins about U.S. ally Abdul Razak. Stay with us. Hamida Rakhshana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show on the U.S. war in Afghanistan, major investigation by The New York Times into the role of one of America's most important allies in the war against the Taliban, a man named Abdul Razak. The Times writes, quote, "For years, American military leaders lionized Razak as a model partner in Afghanistan, their if-only ally in the battle against the Taliban. If only everyone fought like Razak, we might actually win this war," American commanders often said. He ruled over the crucial battleground of Kandahar during a period when the U.S. had more troops on the ground than in any other chapter of the war, ultimately rising to lieutenant general thanks to the backing of the United States. American generals cycling through Afghanistan made regular pilgrimages to visit him, praising his courage, his ferocious war fighting, and the loyalty he commanded from his men, who were trained, armed, and paid by the United States and its allies. The New York Times continues, quote, "But to countless Afghan civilians under his reign, Razak was something else entirely, America's monster," unquote. According to the Times investigation, Razak, who was assassinated in 2018, built his success on years of torture, extrajudicial killing, and abduction. He was responsible for the largest known campaign of forced disappearances during America's 20-year war in Afghanistan. New York Times journalists Matthew Akins and Azam Ahmed spent more than a year on the investigation, traveling across Afghanistan, going through thousands of documents. Their article headlined "America's Monster: How the U.S. Backed Kidnapping, Torture, and Murder in Afghanistan." Matthew Akins joins us now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Tait Media Center, who is covering conflicts in Afghanistan and the Middle East since 2008. His second piece on Abdul Razak in The New York Times Magazine is titled "America's Monsters: Who Was Abdul Razak?" Matthew, welcome back to Democracy Now! Well, why don't we start there? Who was this man? What is his record? And why did the U.S. back him?
Well, I first encountered Abdul Razak in 2009, when I was just a young freelance journalist, newly arrived in the region. And I was in the borderlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I had, by chance, met some drug traffickers who introduced me to Razak. And he wasn't much older than I was. He was barely 30, but he was already the commander of the border police there. He and his tribal militia were fighting fiercely against the Taliban, but also their tribal enemies, and had gotten the backing of the United States. So that's how he began. That's how he got his start as the leader of a militia on the border. But by 2011, as the U.S. surged, the thousands of extra troops ordered by Barack Obama arrived in country, Razak was appointed to Kandahar province, which is a very strategic province in southern Afghanistan, focus of the surge. And so he became a key partner of the United States at the centerpiece of this strategy. And he ruled over not just that province, but eventually became the most powerful man in the south, one of the most powerful in the entire country, became very popular to those who hated the Taliban. And he was finally assassinated in 2018 by a Taliban undercover hitman. And when that happened, he was standing next to the top U.S. general in the country, General Austin Scott Miller, who lauded him afterward as a great friend and patriot.
And you note that because of brutal methods, he was also effective in pacifying or controlling a significant portion of the territory that he was in charge of. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. This is a paradox that I want to investigate with my stories. We want to show the extent of his crimes, that this had happened at this scale, which we did. But I also want to understand why, because, you know, the U.S. military, they had this hearts and minds strategy where they were supposed to win over the population, because this war against the Taliban, a guerrilla war, wasn't a battle between armies for terrain. It was a war over population, right? So the idea was that they had to win over Afghan heart and minds, but to support someone like Razak, who committed such brutality, would seem to fly in the face of that. It seems like a paradox. But what I discovered is actually this is very often how these wars are waged, whether they're by, you know, brutal dictatorships like in Syria or by the French in Algeria, the U.S. in Vietnam. These counterinsurgencies, these small wars often involve tremendous violence against civilians, because their wars over for control of the population were both sides. You know, they threaten people, they murder them, they torture them in order to get them to cooperate or at least not support the enemy. The Taliban did that. They committed violence against civilians. And so did Razik. And in many ways, he did the dirty work that the U.S. couldn't allow itself to do, couldn't admit to itself it was doing, but that it was nevertheless effective. And so this violence, this brutality, it had a logic, it had a reason, it benefited certain people. And that's one thing I really wanted to show with this piece.
And also, you obtained new documents through the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit and other sources. What did they reveal about how much the U.S. government knew about the atrocities that were being committed by Razik?
I mean, they showed that the U.S. was aware of his drug trafficking and his involvement in massacres going back to at least 2006. And there were repeated instances where these kinds of abuses came to the U.S.'s attention. So we got documents that showed that. But I also spoke to the top U.S. officials in the country, General John Allen, four-star general, Ambassador Ryan Crocker. They both told me that they've been aware of these allegations against Razik. General Allen actually stopped handing over prisoners to Razik in 2011 after he saw evidence that Razik had, and his forces had murdered and tortured prisoners. But the U.S. continued to work with him. General Allen's subordinates continued to work with Razik side by side because he was just so effective in the war that they thought they didn't have any other choice. And so they worked with him despite knowing about these abuses.
Matthew, you met with survivors of torture inside Razik's prisons, visited morgues where corpses had been exhumed from desert graves. One caption on a photo accompanying your New York Times investigation reads, quote, "Mass graves have been discovered in Kandahar, but under U.S. pressure, the International Criminal Court has deprioritized investigations into abuses committed by forces like Razak's." Can you explain further?
Well, you mentioned earlier in your segment, you know, the targeting, you know, of ICC officials by the Israeli government that we now are hearing about. Well, let's not forget that President Trump also imposed sanctions against the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. And that was mostly in response to the threat that the ICC would investigate war crimes committed by U.S. forces and by U.S.-backed Afghan government forces in Afghanistan. And so when the new prosecutor came in, Karim Khan, he said that he was going to deprioritize that. He was going to focus on the Taliban, who, of course, have committed their own war crimes against civilians. And the same thing is happening now with the U.N. I think there is this eagerness to turn the page and you know, close this chapter, this shameful chapter in American history among a number of parties and to focus on the Taliban. But I think it's a tremendous mistake not to learn from the lessons, the hard lessons of America's longest war, because there are some very troubling revelations, not just that these crimes were committed, but as I said, because they're committed for a reason, because these kind of things work in this kind of war, that there are reasons why, you know, militaries historically commit violence against civilians in these kinds of irregular conflicts. And of course, we live in an age of irregular warfare. Most conflicts that happen worldwide are not between armies on battlefields, but are, you know, guerrilla wars or, you know, internal civil wars. So it's absolutely vital that we have a reckoning with the past, in my opinion, and that's what we've been trying to do. We've been going back now because there is a lack of fighting in the country. There's relative peace. We're able to get out on the ground and travel to areas that were hard to access before and get to the bottom of what really happened these last 20 years.
And you also write that Razik's brutality was, according to you, quote, stirred such enmity in parts of the population that the Taliban turned his cruelty into a recruiting tool, broadcasting it to attract new fighters, obviously against the U.S. occupation. Could you elaborate?
Well, Razik was basically the poster child for brutality by the U.S.-backed government for the Taliban, right? He was famous. It was a civil war. So, you know, he was beloved by one side and hated by the other. And that was undoubtedly an important recruiting tool for the Taliban. But we have to remember the Taliban, they won, right? And they were incredibly brutal towards civilians. So there is this assumption, I think a comforting one, a belief that we have that brutality backfires, that it won't work. And so if brutality doesn't work, then the discussion's over, right? There's no temptation to use it. But as a matter of fact, it does work in some circumstances. There is a temptation to use it. And it's clear that the Taliban's brutality did not prevent them from taking over Afghanistan. So we're really trying to take a deeper look at what really happened and why the U.S. backed Razik, why he succeeded, why ultimately the Republic failed. But I think one important reason why the Republic collapsed is because of a kind of dishonesty and criminality that was attached to this sort of brutality. So the Taliban were open about their brutality. They justified it, you know, in terms of resistance against a foreign occupation and in terms of nationalism and religion. Whereas because Afghanistan was supposed to be a democracy that respected human rights, what Razik was doing had to be hidden. It had to be carried out by criminals. It bred a deeper criminality. And it also bred a kind of wishful thinking and self-delusion on the part of the United States. I spoke to a lot of U.S. officers who worked with Razik. And while on one hand, they knew what was going on, like everyone knew what was going on, on the other hand, they found excuses and ways to say that it wasn't happening under their watch or they weren't sure. And that kind of self-delusion and wishful thinking on a larger scale on many issues, I think is part of the U.S. failed in Afghanistan despite spending 20 years there and so many hundreds of billions of dollars.
I mean, that is really the key point that you take away, and the whole issue of what it means when the U.S. backs a kidnapper, a well-known murderer. You're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of victims in Afghanistan. Your final thoughts in this last 30 seconds we have as you conclude that it is part of why the U.S. lost the war in Afghanistan.
Well, I think that it's time to have a frank reckoning with our history, and I hope that we'll continue to do this. This isn't the last story. We're working on a series, and we're going to be speaking with people who want to speak about the truth, because I think it has a lot to say about the other wars that are happening right now around the world, and so we need to take those lessons from our own.
Matthew Akins, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, competing for the New York Times Magazine, New York Times Investigation, America's Monster, and we'll link to your series. A fellow at the Type Center and also at the Radcliffe Center for Advanced Study. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Shrouf Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for Democracy Now!
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.